Ladies and gentlemen, let's rise and maintain our mindful silence as we put our palms together in Anjali position to welcome Ajahn Brahm on stage. Ajahn Brahm, please. Good evening once again. Thank you for joining us today for a special talk by Ajahn Brahm on wisdom in the age of information. Ajahn Brahm is no stranger to many of us. A witty and humorous speaker with great insights and wisdom. A theoretical physics graduate from Cambridge University, he has spent more than 20 years in the forest practicing meditation and is now the abbot of Bodhiyana Monastery in Western Australia with 40 monks under his training. He is also the spiritual patron of Buddhist Fellowship, Singapore. Without further ado, let's invite Ajahn Brahm to speak with us. Ajahn Brahm, please.
Very good. It's nice to be back here again. And I usually come through Singapore, usually on my way to somewhere else, on the way back from somewhere else, so I can get a free breakfast in the morning and a place to sleep at night. So this is like working for my accommodation. But I'm also really happy to give talks and to share the wisdom of a monk and how we can develop wisdom in the information age. But first of all, I would want to make an observation. In today's information ages, people all have iPads, iPhones and iPods, and you can see straight away that each one of those devices, it centers on I. They are very selfish, as their name suggests. Next February, I'm going to spend a day at Google teaching them how to rebrand their products. And so the next product will not be an iPhone, it will be a We phone, an Us pad, a You pod. Not an iPhone or an iPad. Because you can see just how selfish and self-centered those machines are. And indeed, one of my friends, he was our IT guy in Perth, and we sent him to Silicon Valley last May, I think it was, for one of their big conferences. It was a Wisdom 101 conference. You're going to have another one over here in Singapore, apparently in June sometime. But this was the one they hold in Silicon Valley. And they had their name for their conference, which was Disconnect to Connect. It was a very apt title for the whole conference. The disconnect, so you can connect with yourself, with your family and loved ones, with your body, and with life. To be able to disconnect so you can connect. Because real wisdom does not come from devices. Real wisdom comes when you actually stand back from the devices. Real wisdom comes when not you're emailing somebody, but when you're standing right in front of them, where you not just see the words, but you see where those words come from. You get the body language, the emotional language, even the smells. It's about learning how to fully communicate with somebody. And when you can learn how to do that, you are starting to connect again by disconnecting. And you're also learning how to connect just even with the weather. I just was giving a retreat in Genting. I know there's something called casino meditation. This was not casino meditation. We were at a temple a little way down the hill from the main casino. But there's many people there who are having a hard time connecting with themselves, being what we call mindful. And so I told them, look at how you are dressed. Now for Malaysians, the Genting Highlands was very cold. So they all had jumpers, jackets, beanies, scarves, three or four pairs of socks, and then their shoes. And I was just saying, just how you're insulating yourself from nature. And how you go outside and you have an umbrella so you don't get wet. And I asked them, can you remember the time when you were young When you go outside and get soaking wet, maybe your mother would tell you off, but you had so much fun, you're actually feeling life. You could feel the cold. I asked them to please, for goodness sake, take your shoes and socks off and actually feel the floor. It's one of the reasons why in temples you have to take your shoes off when you go inside a temple. You can actually feel things. I know that somebody suggested one of the reasons in Buddhist temples you have to take your shoes off before you go into a temple to listen to a talk is because it's a fashion these days. If you don't like the talk, you get your shoe and throw it at somebody. That's what they did to Mr. Bush and a few other people. So if I tell a bad joke, you know, you can't throw your shoes at me in a temple, but here you've got your shoes off, so I better behave myself. But sometimes when you've got so much stuff on you, you're not really connecting with life. And this is one of the symbols of the problems with the so-called information age. Now, we always think that information is in a book. Information is in words. Information is... where is it? A lot of times the information is learning just how to disconnect, so then actually you are connecting with the source of real information. Now, there is an old story of mine which I wrote about in my first book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, which is a powerful story about how to disconnect in order to connect, how to find wisdom in your life, and how it is so hard to find wisdom these days, because these little places where wisdom is born, where you can disconnect, is so hard to find these days. And that was a story when I was 18 years of age, and I went for a traveling in Central America, in the jungles, and they were real rainforest jungles. That was in 1969. And I wanted to go to these pyramids in the middle of the Yucatan Peninsula. These were the relics of an ancient civilization called the Mayan Indians, which had disappeared in the 15th century, and no one knew exactly where they went. By the time the Spanish Cortes and his friends came there, it was just already disappeared. And so they didn't know what that civilization was all about. But they had left these huge monuments, these great pyramids in the middle of the jungle. And I was always wanted to go and visit these. So I decided to take a trek 3 days from Guatemala City, the back of trucks, on fishing boats, down this river in the middle of the jungle. And it was just so remote that you did see indigenous people coming with no clothes on in a dugout canoe. It was just like the movies. Any moment I expected Tarzan to come swinging out of the trees. It was just that sort of ancient. And eventually, after 3 days of hard traveling on the back of trucks, on anything I could find, I arrived at this archaeological site in the middle of the jungle. Now, archaeological sites these days, you have to get tickets to go in. You have fences all over the place. Signs, you can't go here, you can go there. This, there was no one around at all, except for one sort of archaeologist who was totally ignoring me. So I had the whole freedom of that site. And we were the only two people there. My driver just stopped and just rested and slept for a while. I had the whole site to myself. The site is now called Tikal, T-I-C-A-L, in the middle of the Yucatan Peninsula. And many tourists go there, but this I had the site to myself. And I was only 18. I was a boy. Now, when an 18-year-old boy sees a pyramid, he wants to climb up. I don't know why, but if it's there, you've got to climb it, conquer it. So that's what I did, not really knowing what I was doing, climbing up this really tall pyramid to the top. And when I got to the top of this pyramid, I had like an awakening, understood what the meaning of these pyramids were. And it became a story which I put in Opening the Door of Your Heart, which I've told many times, about where wisdom comes from and how we do need to disconnect to become wise. Because at the top of that pyramid, I noticed that it was just above the tree line. So because it was above the tallest of the trees, it was for the first time in days, 3 days, 4 days, I had seen vast distances. I could see the horizon. Because in those ancient days, in jungles, and this was 1969, the Guatemalan government was a third world country, hadn't developed anything, maybe just the city of Guatemala City, that's all. So there was no development there. This was ancient. When they did cut a road through that jungle, single track road, after 6 months, the trees, the vines would grow over the road. And so you were going through tunnels. Even the rivers, you know, the trees would grow over the top of the river. So you would never see the sky, only maybe a few blotches of sunlight just trying to find their way through the thick leaves of the jungle canopy. And so I hadn't seen far distances for 3 or 4 days. I'd never seen the horizon. And I didn't realize what that was doing to me until I found out what it was like to go on top of that pyramid above the tree line. The first time in days I could see vast distances. And I could also see, you know, like Google Maps, be able to see where I'd come from. I could see the town of Flores where I'd slept the night before. It wasn't that far away, but it was just so hard traveling through the thick jungle. It took me all day to get there. And you can actually, from the top of the pyramid, you could see it. You could see the road which I came from. See where the rivers snake through the jungle. You had an overview of the place in which you lived. And I thought, this is the meaning of these pyramids. Because I imagined a young man or a young woman who'd been born in that jungle, lived all their life in the jungle, and at some initiation ceremony, some rite of passage into adulthood, they were taken for the first time up to the top of this pyramid. And when they got there, now I'd just blown my mind for 3 days in the jungle. These people had been born in the jungle. Imagine the first time ever they could see the horizon. And the first time they could stand up, then they could look where their villages were and the roads which connected them. What it would do, it would give them the wisdom of how everything fits together. How their world, how their life interconnects. Because they see it all in one big picture laid out in front of them. And also, how they can look in all directions and see the infinite with nothing between them and infinity in all directions. Just what a beautiful mystic spiritual experience that would be. And how afterwards they'd get the wisdom of the meaning of their life when they could see it from above. And I realized that that is actually where wisdom comes from in our life. To be able to somehow disconnect from the jungles in which we live. The jungles of our business, of our cities, running around, rushing around, even the jungle of our monasteries, to somehow get out of it for a little while. Find a pyramid, find a tower, find a tall hill or tree where we can get out and get some perspective on our life. You know, that used to be the job of things like churches and monasteries and holy places. Because I always recall as a young man, you know, working in London or sometimes doing business in London, one of my favorite places in London was Westminster Cathedral. It was vast. And it was so silent in those early days when I was growing up that I could be busy doing some business or work, shopping or doing visas or whatever else it was I was doing. Tired, worn out, stressed from the busyness of a London life. And I'd go in that cathedral, find a quiet place and just sit down. I'd get out of the jungle of my busy life. And in that quietness, in that serenity, I could just relax. I'd become peaceful. And I'd begin to see what, you know, what was really important, what wasn't important. I could get wisdom, a perspective, through leaving the jungle. But you know what happened? I think just about 6 months before I went to Thailand, now, I was in London, and I thought I needed a rest. So I went into that cathedral. And as soon as I walked in there, I almost cried. Because the people running that great cathedral had decided to install a PA system in which they were giving announcements every few seconds and sermons over the PA system and advertisements of when the next ceremony will be held or where you can buy, you know, the souvenirs or support the temple. They had destroyed the silence. And now it was not a sanctuary, you know, from the jungle of London. The jungle of organizing, asking for donations, doing stuff, planning things. That jungle had gone inside the cathedral. And it wasn't a sacred place anymore. I had to find somewhere else. And you know that it's so important for people to get their own wisdom, not to learn it from monks like me, not to learn it by reading books, even though we've got lots on sale outside. And you don't get it from professors at universities telling you what to believe and what is right, what is wrong. The only way that you can get that information, because there's so much of it out there, is actually to rise out of the information jungle. To leave it for a little while. Find a quiet place. That was the job of monasteries, of temples, of churches, of sanctuaries. Sanctuaries was peaceful places. Not sort of places where you do rituals. He reminded me of this story, this man who came and told me that he visited Thailand. He was a Buddhist, he was an Australian Buddhist. And when he went to Thailand, he went into one of the temples in Bangkok. And on his way into the temple, he saw this Thai girl on a bench in the temple grounds, crying her eyes out. She was weeping, she was hysterical. And he thought, I should help her. But his second thought was, maybe that's not culturally appropriate. You know, sometimes foreign cultures, especially Thai cultures, you've got to be very sensitive of what you can do, what you can't do. And he thought, I should help out of compassion, but I'm afraid to in case I offend somebody. So he decided against, you know, trying to help this lady who was obviously emotionally very disturbed. So he went inside the temple, did his business, whatever it was, and after half an hour he came out and he saw the woman still sitting there, but she had calmed down. She wasn't sobbing anymore. She was just sitting there wiping her eyes. And he thought, no, I should try and do something. So he sat down next to her. She could speak enough English that, you know, they could chat. And he asked, what was wrong? You know, why were you crying so much? And why did you come to the temple to cry? And she told him, sir, just about 40 minutes ago, I lost the keys of my car. That's why I came in here to cry. Now that's only a small thing, you may think. But if that's your car, and it means you can't get home, and all your plans are all put up in smoke, and there's all sorts of trouble and difficulty when you do a simple thing like lose the keys of the car, it can make you upset. But the wonderful thing for her, she knew there was a place that she could go to cry. The temple. And she knew that she didn't want a monk or a priest to come up to her and solve her problems. All she needed to do was to disconnect for a little while. Find a place to get some peace. Some solitude, actually to get perspective. Let the tears go, and then, you know, she said she felt all right now. She'd call a cab and get home and find some spare keys later on. But she felt okay. And you know that sometimes that's all we need, and it's so hard to find. Just a quiet place to cry. A quiet place just to sit, be still, and all the problems of our life, we get perspective and they get solved. We don't need counselors. We don't need experts. We just need some silence, some space. And it's beautiful when we do have So Forest Monastery to give that space. And an associated story about 4 or 5 years ago. Remember to disconnect. To connect, please turn off your mobile phones. My story is, if a mobile phone goes off in the middle of a talk by a very powerful monk, your mobile phone makes very bad karma. And your mobile phone, because of the bad karma of interfering with the Dhamma talk, your mobile phone in its next life will be reborn as a parking meter, which is the lowest form of life for technology. So please disconnect, because it's so important to have some silence every now and again. So about, I don't know, 10-15 years ago, a fellow came to see me in the monastery in which I live in Perth, and he said, "I want to thank you." I said, "For what?" He said, "For your car park." I said, "My car park? Why?" And he announced himself as a member of the local council. He was a building inspector who approved buildings or didn't approve them, argued with the builders. It was a very stressful job because everybody wanted their plans approved yesterday. They had a tight schedule. This was their livelihood. And this fellow had to apply the law, and sometimes it didn't fit. He was always getting into arguments with builders. But he said whenever he got stressed out at work, whenever he had problems he could never solve, whenever he thought he was going crazy, he'd get in his car, drive to the car park of Bodhinyana Monastery, and just sit there for half an hour. That's all he needed. A quiet place, a safe place, where he could just relax, do nothing, soak up some of the peace, and he'd go back, have the answers to his problems, wise and contented. He said, "Thank you for having a car park where people like me could come." He didn't want to come into the hall because then we'd ask him questions. We'd try and help him. You don't always need to be helped. You just need to be time by yourself. And this is the essence of the talk I'm giving. Wisdom comes from silence. It's not something you have to rely on other people to find out. You don't have to get information to be wise. Look, my master, my teacher, Ajahn Chah, he only did 4 years at school. That is all. Grade 4, and that was all you could do in the northeast of Thailand, you know, when he was young. And I went to Cambridge. And when I looked at him and looked at me, it was obvious who was smartest. 100%. And so, where did he get his wisdom from? Where did he get his deep understanding? That fellow was a genius, an emotional giant when he came to understanding things. Look, one of the stories which comes to mind is a... Right, it's a couple of... No, I better don't do the gross story, I'll do the funny story. Because people in Singapore, in Malaysia, they asked me to say a few things about people being possessed by spirits. Because you guys always are into that, possessions and spirits and all sorts of ghost stories. You love that sort of stuff. Which is, maybe I should tell you a ghost story. Do you want me to tell you a ghost story? Well, you asked for it. So you can't complain. This friend of mine, he went into one of the old pubs in London. Now some of these pubs in London have been there for hundreds of years, 400, 500, 600 years. They're ancient. And many things have happened in those pubs. Dark things. Cruel things. And if there's any ghosts, surely in those very ancient old buildings, there must be a few. So this old man, this Australian, he went into one of these pubs, not knowing what the pub was. And he was a bit disturbed when there was no one in the pub at all except the barman. It was empty. I wonder why a pub in London was so empty. What do you think? Anyway, he ordered a beer and he sat at the table and started drinking his beer. And he heard the sound. "The ice jacket you're wearing. Nice jacket." "Who said that?" He looked around, there was no one there. The barman was about 10 meters away. So he thought, imagination, because that's what you think, first of all. So he carried on drinking his beer. And he heard, "Nice pair of shoes as well." Really loud. And he said, "Well, who said that?" And the barman said, "I never said it." And then a third time he heard it. He said, "And it's a nice hat. A nice hat you're wearing as well." And he realized it wasn't a barman. And there was no one there. It must be supernatural. So he finished his beer and went to walk out, more like running out, and told the barman, "There's a ghost, there's a ghost." And the barman said, "What do you mean a ghost?" "Well, I was sitting over there and I heard distinctly this thing say, 'You are wearing a nice jacket, you're wearing nice shoes and a nice hat too, and there's no one there.'" And the barman said, "Oh, that is the peanuts. They're complimentary." You asked for it. I did warn you. So anyway, back to being silent. They're complimentary, okay. So back to the wisdom born of silence. A lot of times, this is where we can really understand, instead of actually connecting, to sometimes disconnect from life for a little while. Find some peace, some silence, even a little bit of solitude. To disconnect from all those other things which separate you from real life. You know, again, learning how to get wet. Learning how to get muddy. Learning how to get cold or hot when the weather is cold or hot. Feeling just like you did when you were a kid. Remember those times just playing in the mud, getting really dirty, getting into trouble from your mother for messing up your clothes. But you were alive when those things happened. You were real. How many times are you allowed to do that these days? How many times when you're on the way to work are you allowed to get soaking and all of your makeup starting to run down your face? Wouldn't that be fun to do? Because that insulation, you know, from life, you know, that insulation from talking to other people, that is where we don't get wisdom from. You know, sometimes you can spend the time with a person and you never get to really know them. Simply because, you know, you're not being real with them. You know, you're acting, you're pretending, you're just... So a lot of times, it's great just to be with a person on a retreat and be silent and really get to know yourself and get to know the other people in a different way. There's sometimes, you know, that we are... Because on a retreat, one of the things which you are doing, you're being silent within. To be silent within, this is also where we get wisdom from. Because then we are listening to life. So much time we're actually talking back at life in our head. If I could get a machine to record what was going on in your head right now, a lot of times you'd be talking when I'm talking. Somebody did some research. I saw this in Time magazine years ago. When most people give a lecture, 90% of people are thinking sexual fantasies. And the other 10% are fast asleep. That's what it said. Now, when your partner, your husband is talking to you, what's going on in your head? Are you really listening? Or are you thinking, when's she going to shut up? How many times do I have to listen to this? Doesn't she know I'm tired? We've gone over this before. Now, how often do when somebody's talking to you, that you have a counter conversation in your head? You're not listening. Now, that might be something with your partner, but what about when life is talking to you? When the world is teaching you, and we are thinking so much inside that we are not listening to life. So I like the idea of disconnecting from your thinking, being quiet, being silent, so then you can listen to life and you can hear her telling you all her secrets. Even learning how to listen to your body. Because I read a book a long time ago written by a top cardiologist. And the thing which I remember from reading that book is that heart attacks, they don't come out of the blue. You don't suddenly get this big heart attack and come so close to death or actually die. You have many warnings before the big one comes. You have many minor tremors in your heart, giving you warnings. You have to change your lifestyle or change your diet or change something. But most people aren't listening. They're so busy thinking, doing something, that they're not really here when the body is trying to teach them something and tell them and warn them. And you can understand that if one can listen more to one's body, it's amazing just how much more one will hear. And one will hear the warnings. One will be able to take evasive action and have a far better health outcome. I am now, this is my 64th year, and I was telling people I am very healthy. And I proved it last February. I went to Bhutan and we climbed up Tiger's Nest. And I know some people from the BF have been there and only got halfway. And they're half as young as me. And I was the first up. I was so quick going up to Tiger's Nest Monastery that all the people on my group, mostly Indonesians, they were calling me the Kung Fu Monk. Old but strong. So that became my nickname on that tour. So how can you... And look, so many other people I live with, they always get these sicknesses. They get colds, they got flus, they get all sorts of stuff. I never get anything. That's why I've never cancelled a visit to Singapore because of ill health. I've never said, no, I can't come, I've got the flu. All these years I've been coming here, I've been coming, never cancelling once. Why? It's because I'm in good health. Although, I did go to Indonesia once and had to cancel. But it wasn't my fault. It was I was flying Garuda and the aircraft was delayed 24 hours. And you know why it was delayed? No, it was the time of the bird flu crisis. Garuda is a bird. So I reckon it got the flu and couldn't get me there on the right day. So it was delayed. Fair enough. So it wasn't me who was sick. It was the aircraft was sick. So it's amazing just the good health which I have, and the reason is because I listen to my body. I don't talk back about to it. And I feel it. And I know when it needs a rest. I know when it needs some water. I know when it needs some exercise. If you listen to your body, it's amazing how wise you'll become to her. And there's no two bodies are the same. Trouble with medicine, they do the very best, doctors. But, you know, that you can't put everyone into the same box. You know, that a cold, a flu, a cancer, however many people they are who suffer cancers, that's how many different cancers they are. Totally different. Every person, totally individual. So if you can feel your body, you know how your body works, different than everybody else's. And in that silence, in that wisdom, there you can actually be wise to what you need and why you need it. and you can have much healthier outcomes. Not only that, but all the difficulties and problems which you have in your life, even problems in your business. Sometimes we have to make decisions, and we don't know how to make decisions. I make many decisions in my day. I'm a CEM, Chief Executive Monk. I run many monasteries and temples and organizations. And whenever I have to make a decision, what do? I quiet. I disconnect. Stop the thinking. Have ever you had the problem of trying to remember somebody's name and you can't remember their name? And when the more you think about it, the harder it is to remember. This is an obvious case that wisdom comes from silence, not trying to think about it. And of course, I get into that trouble many, many times. I've just been over to Penang, before that KL. Next couple of months into San Francisco. I go to Korea, to Thailand, and then also in Australia. I meet so many people, and sometimes people come up to me and said, "Oh yeah, I saw you 3 years ago in Hong Kong. Do you remember me?" Oh, come on. I saw thousands of people in Hong Kong. And the trouble is, I don't want to offend people. But then I have to be honest. I'm a monk. I can't lie. So I'm caught between a rock and a hard place. So what do? No, not silence. From silence, I've got this great answer. I say, yeah, you. You're the person whose name I keep forgetting. That means they don't get offended and I'm not telling a lie. Well, not sort of. But look, you can't remember people all the time. But this is the point here, that you know that's a very common experience for people, and if you can just stop thinking about it, the answer comes up. It's the wisdom which comes from silence. And even in business, there is one of the scientists I know, it's Josephson, Stephen Josephson. He invented the Josephson junction. It is what makes supercomputers possible. He got a Nobel Prize for that, the Josephson junction. He discovered what made him a Nobel laureate when he was totally peaceful, meditating, being still. Many new ways of doing things, many sort of innovations, they come from silence. I have had many innovations from my silent mind. One of them, I haven't put into practice yet, but it's probably coming in a few years, was Mac Buddhas. Like a drive-in temple. You know how difficult it is to find time to go to a temple these days in Singapore? So why don't we have a drive-in one, like no McDonald's restaurants? You drive in, and then there's a menu when you first get there, and you can have, like, chanting. Now, is it chanting because of marriage problems, can't find a girlfriend, because of your business is not going well, or because you've got a bad boss, or, you know, because of health, or because of someone has just died? So you press the button, and then you have another person comes on and say, "Do you want holy water with that?" And a little nozzle comes out and gives you a spray. And if there's counselling, that's at another window. You press, is it counselling for because of, again, business, because you're depressed or because you're stressed? And it's the same old stories come out. So you get the headphones, you get the counselling, and on the last window you give your ang pao. And then you drive off. It'd be very convenient. You wouldn't even need to get out of your car, and you get everything you get from a temple quick and fast. Look, Buddhas coming soon to Singapore. Hope it never does. But sometimes it's amazing the innovation you can get when you're really peaceful and silent. Because this is what I mean by disconnecting. Finding a quiet place. Finding a place, you know, like a pyramid or a mountain or some space you can just be still for a little while. And when you find that little retreat, resort, getting away from the world. People these days, they say they want to get away from the world, and they go, I can't understand you guys. You get away, you go on holiday. Where do you people go? All you girls, you go shopping to Australia. And you know, while you're going shopping to Australia, all the Australian women are coming to Singapore to do shopping. I mean, there's something really wrong with that. Can't you go shopping in your own home? Not only that, as soon as you have a holiday, you want to go out away somewhere. What do you want to go away for? There's no place like home. There's no bed as comfortable as your bed. There's no cooking like home cooking. You spend all that money on your apartment and your home, and the first time you have a holiday, what do? You leave it. It's crazy people. So why can't you have a holiday in your apartment? Have nothing to do all day. You don't have to travel. You don't have to go through airports. I apologize, James. It's bad for Singapore Airlines business. But it's nice as being in your own home, not going anywhere and having a bit of peace. Why is it that people are always running away? And when you do run away, you find you never get really answers or wisdom. Stay where you are, and wisdom comes to you. Disconnect, and all the answers are right there in front of you. If you don't believe me, there's one of these famous stories of mine about chasing wisdom. And it's the story of I usually tell this in retreats, the story of the donkey and the carrot. Now the story of the donkey and the carrot applies to the West, but here in Singapore, it's the donkey and the durian. So, donkeys are notoriously stubborn animals. If you get a stick and beat the donkey, it's like beating your husband. He still won't do anything. That's metaphorically speaking. And donkeys, you can beat them all day and they still won't move. That is not how you get a donkey to move. You tie the stick onto the back of the donkey's neck, and you tie a string on the end of the stick and a piece of durian on the end of the string. So there's the donkey, and he sees a nice bit of durian in front of it. So what does the donkey do? He likes durian, because it's from Singapore. It's a Singaporean donkey. And so it moves towards the durian. And when the donkey moves, the stick moves, the string moves, the durian moves. So the donkey pulls the cart or pulls the people, always thinking it's going to get the durian, but the durian is always 2 foot in front of the donkey's mouth. No matter how fast the donkey runs, it's always 2 foot in front of the donkey's mouth. Do you understand that simile? That's your life. What have you been chasing? The perfect relationship, the perfect sex, the money, the fame. You know, sometimes it's almost in front of you. You can always grab it, but it's always 2 foot in front. Whatever you aspire for in life, fame, respect, you know, the beautiful love, you know, the best job, you know, financial security. You can see it. It's 2 foot in front. And as soon as you move towards it, it starts moving away from you. That is life. However, donkeys, smart donkeys, donkeys who've read my book, they know how to catch that durian. And it's really simple. What the donkey does, runs after the durian. You've already been doing that already. But this donkey knows how to stop. Stops running after things. Becomes still. Has some peace. Let's go. And what happens to the durian once the donkey stops? Because of momentum, the durian swings further away from the donkey. It goes further than it's ever been before. 4 foot away from the donkey's mouth. But then something strange happens. It swings so far away, it starts swinging back. And soon it's at its usual spot, 2 foot in front of the donkey's mouth.
But now it's coming at great speed towards the donkey. And soon it swings so close to the donkey's mouth, all the donkey needs to remember is compassion. Durian, the door of my mouth is open to you. And that's how the durian gets caught by the donkey. You go chasing after things, you go chasing after wisdom. Do you ever get close to wisdom? When we disconnect, when we stop chasing things, we are peaceful, we are still. Yes, at first, wisdom goes further away from you, but just wait a little while, and then it starts coming to you. And you just sit there, and you find in the quietness of a monastery car park, in just sitting on a bench in some monastery in Thailand, in climbing up a nice pyramid in a jungle, wisdom comes to you. Now that is wisdom in the age of information. The information is way too much. It's a jungle out there. And it's a jungle in here as well. Sometimes that when people try and meditate on some of my retreats, I say that, you know, you should sue your teachers. They've taught you to think too much and to see so little. To think. That's why sometimes I remember as a kid, I'd be sitting in the class and the teacher would say, "What do you think about that?" I'd say, "Nothing." And I got into trouble for that. I could have been this wise person much earlier. You don't need to think about it. You need to see it. You don't need to describe it. You need to feel it. The age of information was well described by a cartoon. One of my favorite cartoons, which was done by the Australian cartoonist Lunig. Very, very smart man. And this cartoon was just one frame, one picture. And in the left half of the frame, there was a family watching the TV. And the TV was some nature channel. Because on the TV was a picture of this beautiful sunset on the TV. On the right-hand part of the cartoon was an open window where the sunset was actually happening. Why is it we watch the TV of a sunset when right through the window the real thing is actually occurring? Why is it that we need to sort of find a partner in life on some dating site on the internet when she's sitting right next to you? Why not go and talk to her, ask her, instead of always having to go through some other means? We miss so much of life, you know, when we are unnatural. Sometimes people complain to me, "Ajahn Brahm, you know, you don't know what it's like in the real world. Real world, come off it. I don't wear makeup. I don't have silicone breasts. I don't dye my hair, because I've got none. I get wet, I get cold. I live in the real world. Do you?" So getting to sort of be real, getting to be inside of yourself, getting to be peaceful, is actually how we really connect with what is going to help us in life. And sometimes I give an example, you know, which affects so many people, like grief. Grief is where, you know, somebody in your family dies, and I'm sure that, you know, there's many of you here. Look back in the past year, I'm sure many of you have lost someone really important. And of course, we got the news this morning about finding bodies of the on the crash site of the Air Asia flight. And I did notice that was something, an A320, and I flew in that this afternoon from Penang. I thought, oh my goodness, the same plane. So we think of all those poor people and the families, now they know that their people are dead. Do we need to feel grief? Sometimes we need to disconnect from life to understand that's not necessary at all. I was disconnected from my culture, English Western culture, by going to Northeast Thailand for 9 years. And this is no exaggeration, a few times I went into remote parts of Northeast Thailand where I was the first white man they'd ever seen. And I remember going to one village, and I was staying in a forest monastery. I walked there the first morning for alms round, and I was the first white man this village had ever seen. They didn't have TVs, no electricity, remote. And also, let alone being a white monk. And when they were putting food in my bowl, instead of actually focusing on where they're putting the food, they were looking at me. And my breakfast was falling on the floor, and I didn't get any of it. All the dogs were really happy because they got all the food which should have been in my bowl, because they were all looking at me, because it was weird. So this was a culture which had never been touched by the West. And one thing I found about that culture was when anybody died, there was no grief. It wasn't there. And the monastery where I spent most of my time was the local charnel ground, where the bodies would be brought to be burnt. You were literally part of the village. So, you'd see them beforehand when their father was sick, you'd see him when he died, you'd go into the house and the corpse was still there while you did the chanting, you'd do the cremation the next day, you'd see the people the next days on arms round every day, you'd see them. They weren't crying. And this was not once. This was hundreds of times. And that really made me question. The thing we call grief, is it natural to being a human being? Or is it culturally added? And the thing which convinced me that it was culturally added was the death of Princess Diana. I was on retreat when that happened, happily meditating in my cave, and when I came out of retreat, even the monks were sad. Oh, have you heard, Ajahn Brahm? Princess Diana has died. And all these people were calling me for counselling. Say, are you related to her? No, no, but it's so sad. Why? And it's just the culture, the media, was actually a culture of grief, of hysteria. Does the crying help? Does it serve any purpose? Absolutely no, because you don't cry for the person who's died, you only cry for yourself. But to be honest. And number two, one person is dead. You don't want to kill other people through grief. You don't want to create more misery in this world. And when I went to this Northeast Thailand, I found that this was not part of nature. It was added onto it. So when I actually left that jungle of grieving, that culture, I moved out of it. I found a pyramid where that wasn't there. So I could look above it and see it's not necessary at all. There is another way. And to describe that other way, and it's one of my favorite stories because it's moving. It was the death of my own father when I was 16. And I loved my father really, really much. He was a great man, and I idolize him even today. He was the one who taught me unconditional love, from which I got the story, how to open the door of your heart, no matter who you are. That came from him. So when he died, I should have been so sad. But I never felt any grief at my father's death. I never cried, not one tear, never cried since. And that was strange. Everyone else was crying, but not me. I didn't feel like crying. And it was only later on when I was a monk, when I had time to get out and examine these things. Why was I didn't feel any grief? And that's where I look back on how I felt. And I recognize that emotion. The same emotion I felt when my father died, I had on another occasion as well. which had nothing to do with death. It was the emotion I always felt at the end of a great concert. I grew up in London, and I saw these amazing concerts, you know, in London. Had some of the greatest musicians of the world would come and play there, you know, folk music, classical music, rock music. You know, I did. I was there the very first concert of Led Zeppelin. I remember seeing the Rolling Stones when I was 11. I remember just going with my brother to this pub, in North London. Only six people turned up to watch this band. You'd be lucky to get a ticket in Singapore if this person performed today. He's called Rod Stewart. Six of us, like a private concert from Rod, just for me, my brother, and four others. Thanks, Rod. And I remember those great concerts which I heard in those days. And I do remember the encore, because you'd always stand up, shout for more, and the band or the orchestra would carry on for another 5 minutes. But they had to finish. And when they did finish, they went home, and I had to go home too. And I remember London at night time, cold, dark, miserable, gloomy, and raining. And in London, it doesn't really rain like it does in Singapore. It's like a half rain. It doesn't do anything properly. It's called drizzle. If you ever want to get depressed, drizzle. And I always remember it drizzling, cold and gloomy, whenever I went out of the concert halls or clubs or pubs. But never once did I feel sad that the concert was over. I never cried after a great performance. Instead, I feel this wonderful sense of privilege and gratitude. How lucky I was to have been there at these great performances. And this is over 40, I've been a monk over 40 years now, this is maybe 45 years ago. And I still remember those concerts and that great music. It hasn't left my memory, my heart at all. What a great time that was, how lucky I was to be there. That emotion was precisely how I felt when I walked out of the crematorium in Mortlake in West London after my father's cremation. That's how I felt when the doctor pronounced him dead. That's how I feel whenever I remember him. What a wonderful performance that was. 16 years. How lucky I was to have been there at the time. That's 5 minutes. The performance is almost over. And that is exactly how I felt. And that's how I want people to feel when somebody dies. What a great time you've had together. What an amazing performance. Thank you for being my father, for being my lover, for being my friend. Thank you so much. And you go out without a tear, with a sense of gratitude, with a sense of beauty. Why not? That is an example of what wisdom is, when we disconnect from what we're supposed to feel. Because I've done so many funeral services. Well, I see these young kids. It's great to have children coming to a funeral service. And they come in there being naughty, playing around, laughing, and then they see their mother or father looking all sad. And they learn grief from the behavior of their parents. They're sad too. They learn grief as a cultural response taught by their family elders. And I want to change that to see if we can get wisdom, not from our culture. Some of the culture is great, but some of them is just, it's counterproductive. It doesn't help anybody. Sometimes people in such grief, they can't even go to work the next week. They keep thinking of their son who died tragically. There's many people who would be able to do nothing for the next month because of the tragedy of the Lost Air Asia flight. What a waste that is. Can't we do things differently? shall we look upon those friends, relations, loved ones who've died and say, what a great performance that was. We're so lucky to have known you. Thank you. It cut short, but at least we remember what we've had. Beautiful times together. Thank you so much. When you think of what you've had, then you have appreciation. When you only focus on what's been taken away, then you have grief. You have the choice. Wisdom gives you that choice. You find you don't need to feel sad. You can respect. You have gratitude. You have love. So this is just learning a different way. And this different way, you don't learn from books. I never learned this from a book. I learned this from being alone, solitude, from climbing up mountains and seeing overviews. I always say that in that pyramid, you could see in all directions with nothing between you and the infinite. It's when we put something between you and the infinite. We put a monk, religion, teachings between you and the infinite. That is what blocks us from seeing. So imagine climbing up that mountain inside of yourself, that pyramid. Nothing between you and truth, the infinite. This is how we get wisdom. This is how we see things. This is in the age of information. It just puts too much stuff between us and the infinite. This is a way of wisdom. Thank you for listening.
Okay.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. We have now come to the Q&A segment. Please SMS your question to the following number, 9674-7072. Thank you.
Disconnect. Or you can put your hand up. Disconnect. Does anyone want to do it the old way? Put your hand up and ask a question. Yeah. You got a question there? No. Okay. Any of the ancient way? Shout out the question. No, you said it had a couple of questions prepared just to get people going. So, Yingying, off you go.
All right, Ajahn, I've got a question here. A burning one, in fact.
Good.
Well, in this information age, we are bombarded with lots of distractions, untruths, and lures for attractive living. So what advice could be obtained from the Buddha regarding this 21st century phenomenon?
Yeah, you can make use of any implement, but please put it in perspective. You know, it's sometimes that we think that these are labor-saving devices, but it always makes more work for you. And you think that you are in control, but your devices control you. So realize that, you know, you are controlled by these devices, and be rebellious on every one of your devices. There is the best button of all, delete. Power off, whatever it is. Those are my favorite buttons. And look, to be quite honest with you, if you don't answer your emails or check your SMSs, you survive. You won't die. The world will not end. You aren't that important. That's the reason I say they call them iPhones. Because they make you feel so important. All about I. So we don't believe in an I in Buddhism. No I, anatta. So, if you don't call it an us phone, call it a no I phone. A no I pad. An emptiness. A pod. And then you can actually switch on your iPod, your emptiness pod, put the buttons in your ears, and there's silence.
It is the Buddha teaching you. For example, there was, I think, on one of these executive retreats that BF arranges, they arrange these in really nice hotels. The next one is in Phuket next June. And somebody asked me, they said, Ajahn Brahm, there was a TV in your room. Did you watch the TV? They actually asked me, because, you know, monks aren't supposed to watch TV, but we're supposed to be honest. So I put my hand up and said, yeah, I confess, I looked at the TV. I said, bad monk, bad monk. I said, no, wait. I say, it is all right for a monk to look at the TV. It is, honestly, it's all right for a monk to look at the TV as long as they don't turn it on. Because if you tried it, look at the TV when you don't turn it on, and if you look carefully, you can see a reflection of the one who's watching. You get a great insight there. You can actually see who you really are. So, yeah, it's okay to watch the TV as a monk, as long as you don't turn it on.
All right, Ajahn, we hear you. But what can you say about people who multitask but seems to get things really done faster than other people who are focused and who are less distracted?
The only thing they get done fast is their life. They die young. So, multitasking. You can only do one task at a time. And the people who are productive, now I've been 63 years now, the people who actually get things done go so slowly. And sometimes you look at them and say, they're not doing very much. But at the end of the day, you see how much they produce, and it's enormous. Productivity declines when you multitask. You can't get anything done right if you're just focusing on too many things at the same time. So to be productive, to have high quality work, it's the old one thing at a time job. Now you have to, in modern world, you have to learn how to pretend to multitask. Because that's what's expected of you. So the boss says, can you do this? Yeah, okay. The boss says, can you do this? Yes, okay. But two ears, in one ear, out the other, that's what you've got two ears for, I keep telling you. The boss says this, you must always say yes, boss. If you say no, boss, you get an argument. Yes, boss, yes, boss, yes, boss, and then forget what he said and carry on doing your work. That way you can focus. Because when you focus, you can only do one thing at a time well. You focus, and because you're focusing on one thing at a time, you actually get it done, you get it done fast, and it's high quality. And then you can go into the next thing. You can get many more things done that way. You know, I had that natural ability. My previous boss, Ajahn Jocko, he always said, whatever you do, you always focus on it, and you do it really well before you go on to the next thing. That's the meaning of my life, where I've become a very successful monk.
But would it be possible that if we do more of that multitasking, we get better, and therefore instead of focusing on one and we do that well, we can do two things and we best we focus and we can do that well too?
I don't think so, because when you're doing two things or three things, I don't know, which one are you going to do? You know, you can't split your mind up. You're not sort of schizophrenic, multiple personalities. You know, you've got to kind of focus on one thing at a time. So this is one of the reasons why, you know, when you learn to so-called multitask, you do nothing really well, and when you go home, you know, your husband is talking to you, but you're multitasking, you're not really listening to him, you're thinking about something else, and then you're also SMSing and you're doing... Sometimes, how can you listen to a talk if you're SMSing? You know, it's obvious, you're trying to multitask, you're not paying attention to anything. So imagine, okay, an example. James Koo, the pilot in front, he's actually piloting the plane which I'm going to fly tomorrow to Perth. At last, I've got you as my pilot. Please, do not multitask. Focus on your main job, getting me to Perth on time. I do not want to end up like that other flight. If you are a doctor and you are and saying you're giving you an operation, would you want the doctor to have, you know, the knife in one hand and just sort of listening to a talk by Ajahn Brahm on his tablets? I wouldn't want that. You don't know what I might say. So just, you know, for example, if you were listening to one of my talks, and you know, you heard the story about crashing at 30,000 feet, and if you explode in an aircraft at 30,000 feet, everyone is so close to heaven it's easy to go the rest of the way. Please don't listen to that talk while you're road piloting my aircraft. Or you're listening to, you know, your doctor, you're doing a heart operation, and you're listening to the story of opening the door of your heart. When you multitask, you don't know what you're up to. So if you're doing really serious stuff, do not multitask.
Yes, Ajahn,
yeah.
I hear you.
Driving the car and doing your makeup at the same time, God, it's really dangerous.
All right, Ajahn, what advice would you give to family members who just can't connect? They are disconnected.
Sometimes put yourself into a room with your family, turn off the electricity, and you've got no escape. You have to connect. One way of doing that is one of the things I've been trying to encourage people. For those of you who've got nice big houses, downsize. Get small apartments, and you can give the difference to the Buddhist fellowship. Because when you downsize, you find just living in a small apartment where you can't escape from one another. And because you can't escape from one another, your children have to learn how to live together. And husband and wife, they can't go into their own rooms. They can't escape. They have to learn how to get on with each other, how to forgive, how to make up. So one of the problems of our modern life, our houses and apartments are too big, which means some people have got their own rooms, which means you don't have to learn how to live with other people. You've got your own space. You can hide away from life. You are disconnected from other people. I grew up in a small bedroom with my brother all my life. We fought, but we had to make up. There's no place to run. I had to learn how to be a diplomat, how not to offend him, because he was bigger than me. But you know, I recently went to England in October, spent a lovely day together. You know, he's my brother, we love each other to bits. Because we grew up together. And some of you may have grown up, you know, even sharing the same bed with about three or four sisters. You have bonded. You're going to be close together for the rest of your life. So sometimes one way to connect is to take down the walls which separate us. Live in smaller houses.
Ajahn, I've got a burning question here, really. I can hear it loud and clear as I read this. How can we tell our children to disconnect when all their friends are connected?
Okay. Children learn by example. If parents are always connected to something, what are your children going to do? So one thing, you can have a rule in your house. No Wi-Fi. How the heck are they going to connect? No SIM cards. It's amazing how much power you have. Just use it. And just, you know, even have a Wi-Fi free day on a Sunday or something. And everyone just hand in their sort of their iPhones for one day. So they can connect together for one day, for goodness sake. So at least, you know, yeah, their friends have got this stuff. But they don't have to have it all the time. So teach by example. It is amazing, when I was growing up, we had a TV, but there was power outages. You know, there was no electricity. And it was incredible. I remember those days. We'd actually talk together because there was no TV to watch. There was no electricity. Wow, isn't that wonderful? We can actually talk. So one thing you can do as a family or the family member, don't pay the electricity bill. and have it turned off. Now that will get your family together.
Indeed, when we are scarce of resources, I think we learn how to get by it, because somehow we just know that we can't get more. So scarcity sometimes, I feel, is something that we should also learn how to cope with. And with that, I guess we appreciate what we have more as well. Okay, the next question. Isn't it a waste of talent or skills if we go into solitude or disconnectedness?
Wow, that's where you get your skills from. That's the whole purpose of life. You start off this world alone in the solitude of the cave inside your mother's tummy. And you finish this life in the solitude of the coffin. And so much of this life you're by yourself. And it's a wonderful reflection that even though you think you're connected and you have, you know, someone you sleep next to every night, it's always the case the last person you see before you go to sleep is yourself. The first one you see in the morning before you say good morning to your loved one is yourself. And so much of the day you are with yourself. It's amazing just how much time we are in solitude, even though there's hundreds of people around us. And if you learn how to appreciate that solitude, that time out, being by oneself, connected to who one is, that is where we learn about ourselves. That is where we grow. You know, in some schools, you know, you're a vice principal, in some schools they encourage kids to go on retreat. Solitude, people, be by yourself. Not as a punishment, but as a wonderful way where they can settle down and learn about who they are. Time to reflect. It's a wonderful thing where you learn a lot of skills, how to connect with yourself.
All right, Ajahn, next question is a connected question.
Yeah.
Besides silence, are there any other ways to gain wisdom? And how do you get a child to focus who simply just can't?
Okay, one other way, again, not just be silence, that's how you connect with yourself. Acts of kindness and compassion. You know, take your kid out to some old people's home or some hospital and get them to connect. Or, I read this article in our local newspaper in Perth. There were some kids with a lot of behavioural problems, always getting into difficulty with the police, going into juvenile detention for a few months, out again, in again, out again. They were troublemakers. And they found a new program where it's only about a dozen of these juveniles adopted a dog and cared for that dog, trained a little puppy, and just took it for walks. And these kids, it changed their whole behavioural life. They had someone to love, and a little dog who would love them. And that was just the catalyst which totally changed the way they looked at their life. They were now connecting with another being. And sometimes children connecting with a human being, it's a bit difficult for them at first. But connecting with a little dog who gives you unconditional love back, it was a life changer for these children. And it was just a beautiful way of solving kids who were going into a life of crime and stopping it by just, here's a dog, train it, look after it. And that was all they needed. So they were now connecting with another being, and the being was connecting with them. And from there, their life was full of connections with real people.
So I guess the trick that you're trying to share with us is that we have to disconnect them from people, undesirable people, and reconnect them with people who are deserving and who could nurture their heart.
Yeah, just compassionate people, kind people. And sometimes even if you go to sort of an old people's home, especially if kids, because kids and old people, they just get on so well together. You know, they're not parents, they're not going to discipline them, they just hang out together. And kids really respect just all the experiences and tales of the elderly. And the elderly just really, they enjoy seeing young people around. Because in their old people's home, they just see old people every day. And it's nice for a change to see someone who's young. So it's great for both. It's a win-win situation. And that is actually where you're connecting with someone who's real, with kindness. And when you connect with kindness, that gives meaning to your life. It makes a beautiful world.
Yes, I think what Ajahn Brahm has taught us is replacement therapy, replacing something that is undesirable to one that is more desirable so they can grow and learn from it. Yes, we have got an audience have a question. Could I pass the mic to you?
Okay. Yeah, very good.
Dear Ajahn Brahm, I have a question regarding cultural behavior that is unproductive.
Good,
I appreciate very much what you shared earlier about cultural behavior that is unproductive. How do we, in real life, deal with that? For example, the story of grieving when people die, when you actually don't feel grief and when you expect it to be grieving, how do you do that without offending all the people who are grieving?
Okay, it's a great question. I've often found that when somebody is not grieving, it helps everybody, and everybody benefits and values and says thank you to you. Just before I started the trip, coming to, first of all, KL, then Penang, then here, there's a very tragic case of one of the families, a Vietnamese family who supports our monastery. Their kid, about 22 years of age, you know, Brian, he was given his first car from his father. He's graduated from university, an excellent kid in all ways. And the first car, he parked it outside of his parents' home. He forgot to put the handbrake on and started rolling down the hill. He chased after it, tried to stop it, and he crushed him to death. And it was a very great tragedy. And when the funeral was being held, you know, I am a very busy man. I had another appointment. I pushed it forward, so I came late to the funeral. When I gave my talk, everyone said, thank goodness you've come, Ajahn Brahm. Everyone was getting deeper and deeper and deeper into sorrow and sadness. And I just raised the atmosphere to a place where we could accept and move on from the tragedy. So if you can not just be another one in the culture who grieves and adds to the sorrow, but you can be like the rock, the one which doesn't move, the one which is wise. You find that people value you so much because you're someone who lifts everybody up rather than just drags them down to the bottom. So it is wonderful to have a person who's wise at a funeral service where everyone else is sad. You can give another perspective, and many of them will thank you for that.
All right, Ajahn, the next question. How could we make better business decisions through disconnecting ourselves?
Ha ha ha. Very good. Now, one way you can make better better decisions by disconnecting yourself is that when you don't listen to others, you can actually innovate and do things a new way. Because when we connect to others, unfortunately we go to all these seminars, business people, where everybody else, by the time the seminar comes to Singapore, it's already been around US and Europe so many times. What you're learning is old stuff. Other people are already doing that. It's not innovating anymore. You have in business to stay ahead of the game. You have to be the first to innovate, not the second. Which is one of the reasons why, you know, I'm going to Google, but I come here first. So if you are keeping your ears open, you hear it before it even gets to the United States. So you can be ahead of the game. Now, of course, one thing which apparently has already got to places like Google is actually the what's it called? Now they're working as a team, sort of like, was it no hierarchies, just a level team with no bosses. And the other thing which I remember hearing was highly innovative and hugely successful was where I think, was it one day a fortnight or one day a month, everybody could actually do whatever project they wanted. And it was not from the top down, you know, anything you were interested in, you could just use the resources of Google and play. And they said that one day of fortnight was the most productive, where people were just going to explore and invent and follow their ideas. Yeah, most of those ideas were stupid ideas, so they got nowhere. But a few of those ideas were totally innovative. And that is where they kept ahead of their competitors. So a lot of times, giving people in your organization one day of freedom a month. No bosses, no one telling you what you have to do or what you have to produce. Here you go, here's the resources of the company, here are the labs, here's all the computer terminals. Do what you want for a day. And a lot of people, they would not play, they would not sort of just get on porn sites or play Sudoku all day or just waste their time. Most people are really motivated. They want to explore, they want to do new things, they want to invent. And to give people that opportunity to pursue their inventiveness on the firm's time was hugely productive. So these are the sorts of things which you can actually do. You can actually invent. Don't follow others. So to make those groundbreaking decisions, those which actually keep your company or your business ahead of others, have a day of experimentation. Doing things in a new way. New ideas. Because it's the new ideas, the inventiveness, that is what gives people the edge in business.
All right. How?
Sorry?
Yes, a question?
Yeah, go on. Talking about grieving, yeah?
Thank you. We were earlier talking about grieving and how it is better not to grieve. So that is something one understands intellectually, but when one is faced with a situation, one just falls into the trap and grieves. Similarly, there are many other things which one understands intellectually. Say, for example, I should not feel angry, or I should not feel sad about something, or I should not mind it because, you know, someone behaves in a particular way which I don't like. I understand that intellectually, but when it comes to facing the situation, one just falls into the trap and is not able to change the behavior. So how do you actually do that?
Okay. First of all, it's giving you an alternative, another option. It's not telling you to take that option. It's actually giving you the option that there is another way of dealing with the loss of a loved one. You don't have to grieve. You can see it in a different way. Now, many people won't be able to do that. And so if they start grieving, you won't say, oh, you're a failure, you're started grieving. Now, to understand what I'm saying here, there's the latest book, you know, the Good, Bad, Who Knows book, which has been out here in Singapore for a couple of months, quite a few months now, is now being released in the United States with a new title. They should not be selling it in the bookshops in Singapore. They're not allowed, but they are. But nevertheless, the new title for the US edition is called Don't Worry, Be Grumpy. Now, the reason why that title came about, and this relates to your question, madam, that I was teaching a retreat and saying, everybody should be happy, it's meditation. Have joy, have fun, smile. And you know, sometimes that you can see little t-shirts says, don't worry, be happy. And that really upsets many people. I don't feel like being happy.
Why should I be happy? I'm not going to be happy just because you tell me to. Just like, I feel like grieving. Why can't I grieve? Precisely. So there was one Indonesian girl. She came up to me during the retreat and said, I'm getting really, really upset. She said, I feel grumpy every morning and you tell me to be happy. And that really upsets me. And so I said, just wait here for a few moments. I went into my office and I printed out on our monastery letterhead a grumpy license. On the letterhead, it was grumpy license in just really nice font. And underneath it says, this license allows the following person, I put her name down, Veronica, to be grumpy. At any time, for any reason, or no reason in particular, signed Ajahn Brahm. Because she respected me, and I signed it, she had her grumpy license, so she'd never needed to feel guilty about being grumpy. She was now allowed, as a Buddhist, to be grumpy. And as soon as she felt she didn't need to feel guilty about being grumpy, she smiled and laughed. She wasn't grumpy anymore. Once she was allowed to be grumpy. There was psychology. So if you tell a person not to grieve, and they want to grieve, then they will grieve double. You say, it's alright to grieve. If you want to grieve, you can grieve. Then there's a good chance they won't. So you give people choices. You don't tell them what to do. Giving people choices. It's not saying you shouldn't grieve or you should grieve. It's not saying you should feel happy or you should feel grumpy. Giving people the choices. Once they have the choices, there's more opportunity not to grieve, not to be grumpy. If you take that choice away, they're going to be grumpy.
All right, Ajahn Brahm, interesting question here on ignorance and the lack of information. Now, this connection leads to lack of information, which then leads to ignorance. Is that correct? How can ignorance lead to wisdom, if that's the case?
Okay. There's an old saying, ignorance is bliss. I remember this saying because one of my favorite cartoons is Calvin and Hobbes. And in Calvin and Hobbes, this Calvin is a very smart young boy. And in this cartoon, his teacher was just introducing the USA Declaration of Independence, where it guarantees every citizen of the United States freedom for the pursuit of happiness. So Calvin made this wonderful logical statement. If I'm guaranteed the pursuit of happiness and ignorance is bliss, school is taking away my fundamental human rights. That's a brilliant argument. But knowledge is not wisdom. That's the problem. Because we think that knowledge will take away ignorance. But knowledge is so different than wisdom. One of my favorite sayings is never allow your learning to stand in the way of truth. Never allow your learning to stand in the way of truth. Because what we're taught is one thing. And it's approximate to truth, but truth is something totally different. There are some times as a doctor you have to put aside everything you've learned to be able to see what's really right in front of your eyes and intuit the sickness and the cure. Sometimes as a monk I have to put aside what I've read about Buddhism to really understand what Buddhism is. So a lot of times the information telling us what is supposed to be true and it's not. Never allow your learning to stand in the way of truth. And also, please understand that information is not wisdom. Information can get you close, but the final bit
the leap which you have to make is where information stops and you start to see what is true rather than believing what somebody else is true. That's where the simile of going up to the top of the pyramid, where there is nothing, there is no information between you and the infinite. This is where you become wise. Ignorance is not sort of the same as stillness. Don't allow information to stand in the way of truth.
Ajahn Brahm, thank you very much for your insights to the questions that we have asked. May we now invite you to your seat amongst us in the audience?
I'll be devoted. Okay. Thank you so much.
In this concluding segment, we would like to show you a short, light-hearted Thai video clip on how technology and information has influenced our life and construct our habits. We hope that you have enjoyed this video and that it has helped remind us of the need for personable human touch and eye contact, as these are fundamentals of communication that connect us more deeply with one another. Buddhist Fellowship would like to thank members and volunteers of BF who have contributed to making this event possible. The putting together of this event would not be possible without the contributions of generous well-wishers who donate to support us to organize the many Dharma learning activities we have in BF for the year. Your donation will be important to help finance the running of events for the coming year. Please put your donations in the donation boxes found outside the hall, and our PROs, some of them are holding that near the door. 2014 has been a very eventful year with sad news of air crashes and natural disasters. As we usher in 2015 in a day's time, may we invite Ajahn Brahm to pray for the victims and to bless us all for a very good year ahead. May the generous donations made today enable us to cultivate merits for peace, love, and success for the new year. Ajahn Brahm, please.
Yeah, back in the middle, so people can see.
So I'm going to do a chanting now with well-wishing. And at the end of the chant, I'm going to do also the sharing of merits. And the sharing of merits especially with those people who passed away in the air disasters and every other tragedy of 2004. First of all, the blessing for each one of you. Sabha Roga Vinimuto Sabha Santa Pavajito Sabha Vera Mati Gando Nibuto Chatuang Pava Sabitiyo Viva Chantu Sabha Roga Vinasatu mate bhavan vantarayo sukhi digayu gopava abhivadanha silitsa nichang vuta pachalino chataro dhamma vatanti Ayuvano sukhang balang. So all the blessings of the new year for each one of you, for your families, for your loved ones, for your health, for your business, for whatever you are doing. And now we'll do the sharing of merits for those people who passed away, especially in 2014. You can chant with me the Idang Me Nyati Nang Hotu if you know it. Idam me nyati nang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam me nyati nang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam me nyati nang hotu Sukhita hontu yatayo. May the merits we have made today and throughout our lives be shared with the less fortunate ones, especially the those who have passed away. May they be at peace. Thank you.
Here we go. Thank you for that.
Once again, thank you all for your kind support and attendance. Wishing you a very good evening and all the best for 2015. See you again.